Welcome to the Packet Pushers podcast. Our topic today is measuring application performance across a network. We're going to focus on a couple of specific scenarios with our sponsor, ThousandEyes. The first scenario is that of the global domain name system, or DNS. And of course, DNS is that first step before one system can contact another, turning a host name into a numerical address. DNS performance matters because not much else in an application transaction is getting done until name resolution is completed. The second scenario is that of endpoint tests, where you can see exactly how an app is performing on the system using that app, for instance, a Windows or a Mac workstation. Our guests today are Angelique Medina, Senior Product Marketing Manager, and Amit Naik, Senior Technical Marketing Manager, both from the team at ThousandEyes. And I want to jump into our conversation directly with Angelique, digging into the importance of DNS. Now, Angelique, by the time this podcast goes out, ThousandEyes is going to have published a global DNS performance report. So can give us the overview. What did that report cover?
Yeah, so this report covers, as you mentioned, the DNS. It covers three aspects of DNS infrastructure. So it covers public DNS resolvers, it covers root servers, and it also covers some of the trends around managed DNS services. So this is actually kind of the born out of some research that we had started back in 2015. So for the last 3 years, we've variously published some of our findings on performance for public resolvers, root servers, and we've also done research on the DNS in China, looking at things like cache poisoning. So we've covered this topic for some time. And this year is a little different because we decided to expand the scope of our coverage, put out more of a formal report, and we also updated our methodology along the way. So this is kind of the first this is going to be the inaugural report, and we plan to put it out on an annual basis going forward.
So it's called a global DNS performance report. Are you actually looking at DNS all over the world?
We are. So we're testing from over 170 sites around the globe. That's on the IPv4 side. On V6 side, we have just under 60 sites that we're testing from.
Talking about DNS, when I think about DNS, I think about that the big Dyn attack that happened is a year or two ago. Can you summarize that attack and sort of the import for us?
Yeah, so the Dyn DDoS attack took place almost 2 years ago. So coming up on October 21st, it's going to be the two-year anniversary of the attack. And what was interesting about that particular attack is that it didn't just affect the intended target, Dyn's. It really impacted a whole number of companies who were using Dyn's service. So companies like Instagram and Airbnb and Amazon.com, and even a large CDN provider, Fastly, which used Dyn, was affected. And that in turn affected Fastly's customers. So it had really this massive impact. And it was because a lot of these companies were using Dyn as their sole source for their authoritative DNS.
So in other words, if I couldn't reach the Dyn DNS server somewhere in my DNS resolver chain, I couldn't get to those services.
Exactly. Yeah. So those services may have been available in terms of their web infrastructure, but if you couldn't find them, then they're effectively erased from the internet.
And by using Dyn as a single source, you essentially have a single source of failure.
Exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of folks think about redundancy for other parts of their infrastructure, but DNS seems to be one aspect of just providing a digital service that's often overlooked. So that's something that we wanted to look at. In addition to all of the measurements we took of the various DNS infrastructures, we also looked at the state of resiliency amongst the large enterprises and SaaS providers. So we wanted to understand what lessons were learned from the Dyn attack. I know that right after the attack, there was a lot of discussion around how this was going to change things. Because, you know, the DNS is something that a lot of folks take for granted. You know, I've heard it compared to, you know, almost like a utility. It's like, you turn on your faucet and you expect water to come out. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of conversations around how these SaaS providers, these other companies would learn their lesson. And what we found was surprising, particularly for the SaaS providers. We found that 44% of them are relying on a single source for their DNS. And a lot of those SaaS providers, they use, you know, one of the public clouds, and very often they're just simply using their public cloud provider for their DNS. So they're, you know, they again have, you know, effectively a single point of failure with their DNS. And we saw earlier this year that, you know, even Amazon, you know, one of the large cloud providers, isn't immune to having their DNS affected. So they were, their DNS service was basically hijacked using BGP. And so all of their users, or many of them, were impacted by that.
So since we're talking about DNS design here, I think there's two points to raise. One is, you mentioned that so there's some SaaS providers and so on that are just using a single source, like their public cloud provider, for DNS. And I just want to clarify, what you mean by that is there's a provider who, in order for you to resolve the host names for their services, they are using a single DNS provider. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so that would be like, oh, I'm hosting an AWS, and so I'm going to use Amazon's Route 53 DNS server, and that's the only DNS server from which I'm going to share my hostname records.
Exactly.
Okay, and what would be indicated by the Dyn attack then is you don't share in that way, just that way. Sure, I mean, you share via Amazon's Route 53. There are multiple availability zones you could leverage there, and in theory, you're building a redundant service, but if all of those services are hijacked or attacked like Dyn was and they go offline, you want a completely separate provider on completely separate infrastructure so that you've got a truly redundant service somewhere else you could offer your host names out to the public.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's possible to architect this redundancy on your own or alongside a provider. It's often easier to use two external providers. And we've seen, for instance, like Amazon.com does this, where they use Dyn and Ultra DNS. So they're not even using their own Route 53 service. They're using two separate providers, which presumably are hosted in diverse networks and facilities. And, you know, so they are, you know, in the event that something happens to Dyn or to Ultra DNS, then they're still going to be available and findable to users. Mm.
So I think a second point here is, yes, there are companies that are sharing their host names out to the world, but then there are those of us who just want to resolve those host names. And we use a public DNS server like Google DNS, 8.8.8.8, 8.8.4.4. I mean, should those of us that are just used to pointing to Google DNS or you know, Cisco Umbrella or, you know, one of these sorts of services out there, should we be using multiple different resolvers as well?
Not necessarily. I mean, what we found in our research is that overall these resolvers are, you know, they're highly available. And you certainly could use different resolvers in your DNS server settings. You know, that's really going to depend on what you're trying to do. There's a lot of really good resolvers out there. So you mentioned Google and Cisco's OpenDNS resolvers also highly, you know, performs very, very well. But another public DNS resolver that performs really well is Cloudflare. So we looked at 15 of these public DNS resolvers and kind of tried to understand how they performed across different regions. And what was interesting is that across the board, so Google, Cisco's OpenDNS, and Cloudflare were really the top three across every region that we looked at. But in North America and Europe, you have a lot of choices for a resolver that, you know, basically will resolve your query in under 20 milliseconds. So not just those three, you have folks like Quad 9 and Clean Browsing, Level 3, and several others that also perform really well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to point out that when using those resolver services, you're not actually pointing to one server that's sitting, you know, in the middle of a country somewhere. You're actually pointing
Correct.
To an Anycast address, and so you're talking to a resolver that's closest to you.
That's
in theory.
Right. Yeah. And all of the DNS resolvers that we looked at are Anycast.
So you mentioned there's sort of the big three, but there are others available. Are there any guidelines that would help me decide which resolver might be the best for my situation?
Well, so as part of the research that we did, I mean, we're looking at strictly, we're really just looking at performance, right? Yeah. So we do break down not only by region, but also by country, what the fastest resolvers are. But that may not be the only criteria that you want to consider when you're looking at who you're going to use for a resolver, right? I mean, that's sort of a broader question. You have to consider things like privacy and security. And ultimately, mm-hmm. it comes down to, you know, whether or not you trust the resolver operator with your queries. Right. So that those are sort of larger questions that you might want to consider. So the idea here is that we're presenting this data that's going to be useful in your evaluation process. But again, you have to consider, you know, what's really important to you as a user. Is it just performance or maybe some combination of performance and security and privacy?
Okay. And trust. So earlier you mentioned something that caught my ears. You said you looked at both IPv4 and IPv6 DNS performance. Were there differences? And can you talk maybe a little bit about them?
Yeah, that was interesting. So we looked at that. And for the most part, particularly if you're for like the top five, so those would be Google, Clean Browsing, Quad9, OpenDNS, Clean Browsing, their IPv4 and IPv6 performance is pretty much on par. The only exception to that, and this was a little surprising, was Google. So their IPv6 performance, particularly in a couple of regions, is quite a bit, is really not as good as IPv4. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that was something that we dug a little bit deeper on and wanted to kind of understand what was behind the performance that we were seeing. Initially, our thinking was, well, maybe they're just not announcing IPv6 DNS service from as many locations as V4. But that didn't turn out to be the case. I mean, we were looking at network latency as a portion of overall resolution time. And network latency was actually very similar for Google for V4 and V6, but the resolution time was just was very, very high. In some cases, we were looking at like 120, 130 milliseconds, and network latency was really just like in the, you know, somewhere under 15, 20 milliseconds. So that was a little surprising to us, and it's unclear exactly what the root cause was, but it didn't appear to be network related.
Yeah, it's not the network.
Yeah, we could get to that V6 service, you know, from a network perspective was fine. But just when you asked it the question, you know, a quad A record or, well, it wouldn't have to be a quad A record necessarily, but just some kind of an IPv6 based DNS query, you're saying it took the server quite a bit of time to respond to that request.
That's right. Yeah. And just to clarify, yeah, so we were actually requesting a quad A record in the case of IPv6 and an A record in the case of IPv4. Although, of course, you know, they're somewhat independent. You know, the network protocol is obviously independent of the record type, but that's how we constructed it. But yes, it was surprising to us that it took that long to resolve the query.
And do you have any insight on maybe what it is about, whether it's something inherent in V6 or is it an issue with how Google has set up this service? Do you have any insight into why that difference might be there?
Well, it's interesting because of the top five that we, you know, so we looked at 15 and of the top five, three of them are actually fairly new. So Cloudflare announced just this last April, Clean Browsing and Quad9, I think they went, you know, they sort of officially launched last year. So there's, you know, three new folks. And, you know, that's a little bit different from Google because Google's been around for a long time. Maybe there's something in the way in terms of maybe there's something around their support of V6 that might be the issue, because it looks like for everyone else, the performance is pretty much on par. This isn't a V6 issue per se. This seems to be something specific to how Google is architecting their DNS.
Which is very odd because Google, I mean, if there's anybody that knows deeply the importance of optimizing a network stack and they've done a lot of their own pioneering work in this area, you'd think they'd be right on top of it, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it may just be that this is sort of a legacy issue where they're still in the process of you know, updating all of their infrastructure to support V6.
It's interesting to bring up this observation, because the kind of the assumption has been for a while that if you move to V6, one of the benefits you're going to get, not always, but in many cases, is nominally better performance. Just the way some stacks have been tuned and so on. You at least you hear that story coming from the V6 community. So this, I guess that's a little bit surprising.
And it, again, it was really just Google that we were seeing this. In the case of the other ones, it was either very even in terms of performance, or there was a slight edge in terms of V6. So something sort of odd is going on there in terms of.
Now, we've made a distinction here between how many milliseconds away the DNS server is, define that as network latency, and then how many milliseconds it might take to actually get the full DNS response. I guess you could call that application latency. So I take it the report maybe highlights this?
We do get it. For the most part, we're looking at resolution time, but where we do see anomalies, we'll dig into the network latency piece as well. And in general, what we were seeing is that the resolution time, the difference between the network latency and the resolution time was generally under 25 milliseconds. So that's the DNS server processing time, or I guess what you could say the application layer. And that was, you know, that was pretty typical. We didn't see a lot of deviation from that, except when, you know, except in the case of like, you know, Google's an example of this and a few others.
25 milliseconds. That's a pretty good rule of thumb. And that feels like what you want it to be. You don't want it to be, you definitely don't want it to be 100 or more milliseconds.
Right, right. Absolutely not. Yeah. Yeah. What was interesting with Google's V6 service as well is one thing we were seeing on the availability side is we kind of ran into some, you know, we had a few of our vantage points that were connected to, were single home to Cogent. And so, you know, I mean, there's apparently some longstanding issue between Google and Cogent for V6. So this doesn't just apply to V6 DNS service, but any V6 address, Google address. And so anyway, so that was affecting some of the availability numbers that we saw with them. But that was interesting to see, like anything that was destined for Google's IPv6 addresses, it was effectively dropped on the egress of Cogent's network.
Bad blood or something.
Yeah, it's hard to tell if that's just policy or if that's just
an argument we're peering into.
That, yes. So, you know, there's plenty of kind of material and commentary on this on various forums online. But yes.
That you are electing not to get into. That's fine.
Yes.
So response caching, it's a key part of how the global DNS scales. Did your testing take that into account in some way, or are you just focusing on authoritative servers?
Yes. So with the public DNS resolvers, we are primarily likely going to be receiving a cache record. You know, obviously a lot of these public DNS resolvers, they serve millions of users every day. And we're querying for a record. So the record is either the A or the quad A record, for example, .com, which has a long time to live value. So it's something, it's like 24 hours. And so that's how long it's going to sit in cache, unless, of course, the resolver operator changes the value, which some operators do. So, for example, Cloudflare will change the maximum TTL to, I think it's 2 hours, and then with OpenDNS and Google, it's like 4 or 6 hours, something like that. So it's less than 24 hours, but that's still not, you know, 5 minutes or 1 minute. Sure. It's still a good chunk of time, and we're testing every 30 minutes. And given that frequency and also the number of global users that they have, we expect that we're primarily querying a record that's cached. Though, you know, it's also possible that the measurement that we're taking could include the resolver's iterative queries to, the authoritative server, and very unlikely, but also potentially root and top-level domain. A lot of resolvers do things like prefetching from root and TLD, so it's not likely that our measurement is including those iterative queries, but it's possible that it could include a query to authoritative.
Okay, so just to clarify, do you feel like you have a good sense between what's essentially a cache response and what may be a fresh lookup?
Well, I mean, we could dig it. We could like look at each response to see what the TTL value is, but that's not that wasn't something that we did as part of our test. I mean, we could certainly go back and look at it, but we're fairly confident that most of our measurements are of cached records.
Yeah, and that makes sense again with those public resolvers that you're querying, because that's their job. They're caching servers. So as you said, the strong likelihood is you're querying against records. Particularly, you increase the odds in your favor since you're querying against records that have longer TTLs. So, okay, a couple of security questions. DNSSEC. Was DNSSEC part of the testing? And if so, any interesting observations to report?
Yeah, so we didn't, it wasn't part of this test, no. It is something that we're looking at for the future, though. So I know there's been a lot of, particularly not only with DNSSEC, but also with DNS over HTTPS, lots of kind of chatter about that recently. And so that is something that we're looking at to include in future tests. And I think that would be very interesting.
Oh, you beat me to my next question, which was DNS over HTTPS. So with the unfortunate acronym of DOL, DNS over HTTPS.
No, I know.
It's terrible. But that is what it is.
I don't think that's unfortunate. I think it's, you know, it's what happens if you don't use it, right? Okay.
Yeah. And interestingly, there's been some ripe reports. Don and Jeff Huston's done a lot of work in this area on DNSSEC uptake and where that is at. And it's still early in the adoption curve at best, and you could even say maybe it's not going to take off. All depends on your perspective as you look at the data with what's out there for DNSSEC. Some people are very aggressive about it, and pro and for it. You know, we're even looking, on our own DNS records, how to get DNSSEC on there in an easily supported way because someone in our audience looked and said, hey, you don't have a DNSSEC record out there yet, darn it. So, okay, we know, we'll get to that. But since the uptake isn't global, it's kind of funny, as long as DNSSEC has been out there, that it hasn't taken off like a rocket. A little bit difficult to deal with. And then DNS over HTTPS is a sort of a different technology, somewhat complementary to DNSSEC, I guess, depending on your perspective. Not competitive, but complementary.
Yeah.
But just emerging. It's still a fairly new phenomenon. There are some binaries out there that support it, but very far from being widely deployed yet. But it's nice to know that it's on your radar there at Thousand Eyes.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting too with DNS over HTTPS, like with some recent initiatives that for instance, like Firefox is leading. That it seems like it's very soon going to be much more widely used. Mm. That's going to be interesting to watch and see what happens.
Are there any other interesting highlights or tidbits that jumped out at you as you were putting the report together?
Yeah, there's a few things. So one of them is with the managed DNS services that we looked at. One thing that was interesting is that, so in terms of these providers that we covered, we looked at cloud providers, CDN providers, and then DNS specialists. And what was really clear was that the DNS specialists had quite a bit of a performance edge over everyone else, which was not something that we expected. So you would think that, if you're using your cloud provider and you're also using them for your DNS service, then their performance would be, pretty good. But we were finding as folks like Dyn and NS1 had really great performance globally in a lot of regions, and also Cloudflare as well, I would say. But primarily it was the DNS specialist that really shone on the performance side for managed authoritative DNS.
Any insights into why that is? Is just because they've, obviously they're specialists. This is, how they make their margin. But do you have any insights into why they're, and is it a significant performance difference?
In some cases, it is significant. So if you look, for instance, at North America and Europe, there's not much of a performance gap across the providers. There's a few exceptions there. But as you start to go into some regions like South America and Africa and Asia, the performance gaps widen. Mm-hmm. And there's really just, often, less than a handful of providers that do really well in those regions. In terms of why that is, I mean, it's, focus. It could be one reason. Maybe there's something in the way that they've optimized their peering relationships, mm-hmm. as well as maybe something to do with their DNS software. In some cases, some of the providers are using proprietary software versus, you know, others that might just be using PowerDNS or Bind. So that's a possibility as well. One thing that we did see that was somewhat interesting was with some of these providers, for instance, even if they had a very extensive global presence, that wasn't necessarily meaningful from a performance standpoint with managed services. And a lot of this performance, a lot of the performance problems we were seeing had to do with just optimal routing. So for instance, there was two providers in Argentina, looking at the opposite extremes of performance. So the one that did very poorly, we could actually see that the traffic that was getting routed to them was going from Argentina to Spain, to Italy, crossing the Atlantic again to Dallas before it was actually reaching that provider. And so that was adding, or, you know, the network latency was contributing to the 170 milliseconds of resolution time. They were only adding about 20 seconds of additional latency on top of that. But it was really just because of this really poor kind of routing that was taking place, whereas the other provider that was peering locally, was able to offer really, really good performance. So, I mean, anytime you're offering a service over the internet, you have to think about things like not just, you know, whether your application stack is performing, but also things like, you know, what are your peering relationships look like? You know, are providers, are ISPs optimally routing to you? So that was interesting to look at up close.
As we're going through these highlights, did you guys tested the root service, I believe. Anything pop out at you as you tested root servers directly?
Yeah, the root servers were also interesting. We looked at IPv6 as well as IPv4, and IPv6 had a slight edge over V4. Not significant, but it was slightly better. The other interesting thing was just, you know, because we've been testing the root servers over time, and you know, so we're also tracking, for instance, as any cast sites expand, how that impacts performance. One thing interesting was just in the last year, I think both E and F added a lot of Anycast sites, and they were really the standout performers as far as the root servers. So that was interesting to see. But yeah, in general, availability, performance, very good, particularly for E and F root.
Now, based on the report, there's a lot of data here. We've been talking about a lot of data points. But as you take all of that information as an aggregate, does Thousand Eyes have any recommendations that DNS architects should be considering?
Yeah, so there's a few things. One of them is what we discussed earlier in terms of resiliency. So making sure that you're architecting for resilience, that may mean that you're using two external providers, perhaps. That would be an easier way to do it. The other thing is, as far as like the public DNS resolvers, it's good to be aware of how these perform regionally. That helps you to have an understanding of how users are impacted by DNS. So making sure that you're looking at DNS as an additional checkpoint when you're doing troubleshooting. It may be that users in a certain region are experiencing poor performance reaching your site because of DNS. And also, you know, there are a lot of enterprises that might have remote offices where they're light on IT assets and they could be using the DNS of their local ISP. And that may not always be optimal. So we actually saw this with a bank in Canada. They had branch offices in South America. And when they had migrated over to Office 365, they were experiencing a lot of performance issues. And it turned out that it was DNS that was the root cause. And when they fixed that, that resolved their performance issues. So, you know, looking at what kind of performance you're getting from your ISP, and then, you know, seeing, you know, using the data that we provide to figure out if maybe there's a better option in that particular region or country, because oftentimes that could be the difference between, you know, good and poor performance. So that's a takeaway for the resolvers. In terms of the managed providers, looking at things like, you know, making sure that you're actually measuring their performance and taking into consideration where your users are located. So if your users are primarily located in North America or Europe, you have a lot of choices in terms of good performers. And once you start to get into regions, particularly like Africa or South America, or even Oceania, so New Zealand, Australia, you have a smaller selection to choose from. So really want to think strategically about what kind of performance you need, where your users are located, and make sure that you're using data to inform your decision rather than just assuming that, you know, if this provider has a lot of locations globally, that they're just going to perform well, or that your default infrastructure provider, whether they be a cloud provider or a CDN provider, is going to offer good service. You want to just make sure that you're actually measuring that and you know what you're getting.
Okay. So speaking of measuring then, so if I'm a ThousandEyes user, should I be performing some set of specific DNS tests, or is the DNS testing actually going to be part of a larger test, like doing an HTTP GET of some remote web page?
Yeah, so our HTTP server tests, they do include, you know, DNS is a component of that. So you'll be able to see that when you're, for instance, if you're testing your site from some remote location or where your users are located, it will be included. But it's always good to specifically target your name servers as well, just to ensure that they're available, and that will also enable you to look at things like, you can also alert on things like if there's any changes in your DNS, which could potentially mean that you're being hijacked, for instance. So there are a number of things that you want to look at, not just from a security standpoint, but also from a performance standpoint. So having sort of a mix of these type of tests will give you that coverage.
Got it. That makes good sense. And that's kind of what I anticipated. I mean, it's nice to look at a transactional test like an application GET of some sort, and then look at the components of that transaction and see that DNS was a part of it. But at the same time, you really do want to focus on DNS specifically for all the reasons you just said. You get an awful lot of specific metrics that can drive decision-making about how your architecture is deployed.
Well, thank you, Angelique. This sounds like a comprehensive report. Ethan did mention at the top that this is a two-part show, so we're also going to be talking about endpoint agents, and this is our chance to bring in Amit. Amit, can you just remind us, what is an endpoint test? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so as you guys are aware, right, so ThousandEyes, our mission is really to help you understand application performance from any user to any network. And as you might recall, a couple of years ago, we launched endpoint agents to give us an end-user perspective into application performance and the underlying network dependencies. And these endpoint agents use a combination of passive and active monitoring techniques to gather this intelligence. When users access an application through a browser, as a lot of SaaS applications are primarily consumed these days, this triggers some data collection. So we collect browser traces, as well as we run active network tests for the target IP addresses, for example, which gives you things like the page load waterfall view. It gives you a nice network path visualization. And then in parallel, we also run network topology tests at regular intervals, and that provides you visibility into your last foot network, if you will. Things like your local DNS server performance, which we just talked about, your wireless performance, how your proxy's doing, whether you have any congestion on your VPN gateway, and things of that nature, right?
Well, actually, let's drill into some of that for a second. So you said wireless performance. What I mean, like, you're aware of the wireless network that you're connected to, so you can get a sense of your wireless performance directly to your AP?
That's correct. So by being on the endpoints, we can actually get a lot of interesting statistics about the nature of the wireless networks, right? Not only signal strength, but loss, what network you're connected to, what AP you're connected to. And by itself, it's not that interesting. But when you start correlating this information across, you know, dozens or potentially hundreds of endpoints, that's when you start to see interesting patterns, right?
Oh, as in, don't think of this data as purely endpoint focused, but think of gathering data from a whole bunch of endpoints and then correlating it at that central point. And you could find out, like, this access point on this floor, everyone connected to this thing seems to be having a problem, and then go from there.
Absolutely. You got it, right?
Okay.
So we've had some capabilities in the product for a while now, and around these lines, we're adding some new ones down the road as well. So you'll see some exciting changes coming there as well. But so from an endpoint perspective, right? So when you start correlating this data across a lot of your users, that's when you start to see interesting patterns, right? You might see that a particular location, a particular branch office has a lot of errors, and that could all point to your ISP connection in that office, right? And this gives you the data you'd need to go back and investigate whether you need to get a second ISP in that location or switch ISPs, right? Things of that nature.
Okay. What endpoints are supported now? I mean, Windows and Mac, I'll assume. What else?
Yeah, so I'll get into that in a moment. So, you know, what we found over the last couple of years is that now if you look at SaaS applications, users typically don't use these applications consistently, right? Especially the users that are more likely to complain about app performance, the executives, the road warriors, right? So they're on the application, we collect a bunch of tests, and then they go away and they do something else, right? So there are opportunities for gaps in the data. And then we also found that certain SaaS applications are consumed primarily outside of the browser. So Slack, for example, right? Slack is a great example. I mean, it works over a web browser, but most users will use the native client. And then if you look at Office 365, all of it can be consumed over a browser, but a lot of organizations are using the FAT client access their email. And so we thought, so what if we collected data for certain targets on a regular intervals, kind of like our schedule tests that we've been able to run from cloud agents and enterprise agents for all this while, right? And this is the capability that we launched about a month ago. And this is, we're calling it endpoint tests. And then it gives you the same kind of data that you're used to from cloud agents and enterprise agents, but from your Windows and Mac OS endpoints.
So are these tests are just running sort of on demand, or are they just sort of running in the background, constantly gathering information?
These are running at regular scheduled intervals, just like our other tests. So you can set the interval that you need. And it doesn't run continuously. We want to be mindful of the resource impact on the endpoints because, we want to sort of be very low touch in that department, right? And so we typically run it at, we recommend 5-minute intervals, give you good data sets. And, so you're not continuously consuming a portion of the CPU in the background.
And is the idea that I would put an endpoint agent on every person, say at a branch office, or do you just want like a reasonable sample size?
So I think it could be whole spectrum depending on the use case, right? So if you're looking at branch office monitoring, you could sort of look at a combination, right? So some of your larger locations could get where you have the ability to put a enterprise agent, a server appliance, right? Those could use the enterprise agent and get the full suite of the testing capability. And smaller or medium branch office locations, you can use the endpoint agents. And ideally, you'd want to deploy these on every single endpoint to get the most complete data set, because if you're looking at branch offices, you're also potentially looking at road warriors. People occasionally work from home. That's, increasingly common. Uh-huh. Or, go work from the building lobby downstairs or from the Starbucks across the street, right? Those types of working habits are getting more and more common. So it's always good to have these agents running on every single endpoint.
But there's a cost component here, I assume, right? Because you mentioned bigger shops that have some resources, they may deploy a dedicated enterprise agent, just let that run, which costs whatever it costs. But then if I don't have that, it's a smaller shop. Maybe I've just got people in office space with their laptops or workstations. Okay, then endpoint agents look pretty interesting. But there's still, there's a budget component I do need to consider.
Absolutely. So there is a cost component that you need to consider here as well, right? And factor it into your equation. So for example, if you have a branch office with 100 users, for example, right? You may, choose to deploy it on all 100 endpoints, but you might get a reasonably good sample set data from 20 endpoints, right? That give you, assuming those 20 endpoints are in the office most of the time. And that way you sort of, avoid issues from, the users that occasionally, close their laptop lid and put their endpoint in sleep mode or get off the network for whatever reason.
Right. All right. Well, what are the sorts of tests that I can schedule? Like, do I get voice testing and HTTP? Just give us some sampling of what sort of tests I can schedule.
Yeah, so for now, what you're able to provision is HTTP server tests, which also includes all of the underlying network tests. And then you can also do agent-to-server tests to specific targets and IP addresses and ports. And we can provision up to 3 tests on an endpoint agent concurrently. So this allows you to test to 3 common applications that you might be using, or a combination of network targets and application targets. So if you're using SD-WAN, for example, right, you can have a test running to target the underlay, right, that's targeting the tunnel gateway endpoint on the other end. And then you can also have another test start going through the overlay, which is targeting an application that you're using. And the 3 test limit is really a software limit so that we don't overload the endpoints and the end user systems, and it keeps any performance impacts down to a minimum.
Yeah, you don't want it to be like some horrible antivirus agent that's sitting there back in the bad old days where we're still half your CPU because it was churning constantly. So I get it. You're just throttling that and you're limiting it that way. It's not that you can't do more than that. You're just being very kind to the endpoint.
And can you drill a little bit into the kind of data that you can produce from these tests?
Sure. So you know, when we went through an extensive beta phase of this, and we found some very, very healthy level of adoption from our user base. And part of the reason is because the data and the metrics that you get from these tests is just like any of our other tests. So you get an HTTP server view, which gives you the application data, such as availability, response time, throughput, et cetera, right? You get a network view, you get a path visualization, you get loss latency jitter metrics, just like any of our other tests. So there's a lot of familiarity here from an end user perspective. You can alert and report on these metrics. And what this gives you is a very rich data set from branch offices, from home users and road warriors. And you know, these tests are running on a regular interval as long as you have the endpoint up and connected to a network. And the real advantage here is that now you can start doing some really good baselining. All right, and you know what good looks like, what normal looks like, and then you're able to monitor for deviations from this baseline much more effectively.
This is normal for this user? This is awful. I can't believe they live like this.
It depends on who you ask, right? The user or the network admins.
I'm imagining someone, a road warrior, going into Starbucks with some graphs and charts and saying, "Hey, you guys got to do something about that AP because I have some expense reports to file and it's not working out here."
Absolutely. And as you look at global user bases, right? I mean, what's good here in North America may be completely different from what's good in South America, for example, right? You need to factor those deviations into account as well.
Amit, one more question about this endpoint agent. What is the installation process?
The installation process is very straightforward. So it's distributed either as an MSI or a package for macOS, right? So you can use all of your standard package distribution methods like group policy, et cetera, to push it out to your end users. And we've been very conscious to keep this agent very lightweight and not load it up with too many bells and whistles. So it's a simple, clean install. It takes very little footprint on the endpoint and gives you the data you need.
Well, Amit, thank you for the update on the endpoint agent, what we can do with that now in addition to what we could do before. And Angelique, going back to you and talking about the DNS report, where do people go if they want to get a look at that?
So you can go to our website, thousandeyes.com, and if you click through to our resources center, then you'll find both the DNS report as well as an executive guide to DNS. We have an ebook there as well. So both great resources.
Very good. And I'm actually excited that you guys are going to be keeping up with that data over time and publishing. It's nice to see trends over time, how things are changing and improving, so that you guys have committed to that, I think, is sort of a big deal. And you seem awfully well positioned to be the ones doing that. So good on you. Angelique, are you social? Do you tweet or blog or anything like that you'd like to share with folks?
I am. So I'm pretty active on the Thousand Eyes blog. So check that out. Also, I'm on Twitter at BitPrince. So follow me.
BitPrince. Okay. I'm never going to remember that. Okay. It's in the show notes, folks, if you remember that. Same question to you, Amit. Do you social anything you want to share with folks?
Yes. Yeah, so I can be found on Twitter at @Nike_Amit. Much more boring name, but compared to Angelique, but you can find me on there. Thanks.
Very good. Our thanks to you for listening to the show, and our special thanks to ThousandEyes for sponsoring the podcast today. Our sponsors help make possible the engineering discussions and news found across our network of podcasts, blogs, and videos, bringing the tech community together. This episode and everything we create can be found through packetpushers.net. Check out our brand new subscribe page for all the RSS. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, rate us on Apple Podcasts, and support us at Ignition, our membership site. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.